It's happening, whether you want it to or not.
It is.
Hello, everyone. It's happening. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the Tuesday edition. Our deep dive into one topic with some news picks sprinkled in, too. Today on the show, we are departing, for the most part, I would say, from the pandemic news cyclone. And just going ahead with a completely different story, which actually is big time. Happening all over, hits squarely on all three of our interests, tech, the economy, and culture. We are talking about China, specifically U.S. relations with China that have gotten so bad that some people are calling it a new Cold War.
There is the battle over technology. We'll talk about that. There's Hong Kong. We'll talk about that. There's the trade war, which is, oh, by the way, still going on. All of that stuff. And none of it seems to be getting any better. In point of fact, it's actually getting worse.
Yes. So our guest on the show today, we're just making it easy on ourselves and getting the best. Jennifer Pak, our China correspondent, based in Shanghai, who stayed up until 1 a.m, bought a very expensive cup of Starbucks in order to make us smart. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys.
I want to get to the $7 cappuccino first, actually.
Sure.
Is that normal?
Starbucks, I think, on average, is more expensive than any drinks in China. But it set the bar. You know, it really brought in the coffee culture. Normal cappuccino, I think, is whatever you call small, whatever small is like $4 usually. But I went to the Starbucks roastery, and I just said cappuccino at 10 o'clock at night. And they said, oh, okay, it's going to be $7. I said, wait, hang on a second. Why is it almost double? And I think they said it was some sort of fancy bean. I didn't listen to it, but I was stunned. But you know what? It was packed. Oh, okay, so U.S.-China relations, whatever. Right. It was packed. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, that's sure. Actually really good. So my local Starbucks down the block is external only, right? You can go and stand in line having pre-ordered all that jazz. The Trader Joe's next door, basically they're metering people in and lining up outside. What's it like on the streets of Shanghai pandemic-wise?
For the most part, people are starting to take off their face masks, except for public transport.
Wow.
Inside certain buildings, they require it, like shopping malls maybe. But otherwise, Shanghai in particular has kept things under control. So, yeah, you don't really have to wear face masks as much. It's been sort of what you would call, quote unquote, back to normal for a while. But what I have been noticing when I bike around the streets of Shanghai is that the smaller shops, maybe they survived reopening, but they didn't last because, you know what, people aren't spending as much.
I'm still flabbergasted at starting to take off face masks, considering that there are many, many places in the United States where people have yet to put them on, which is wow.
Oh, yeah. People have been chin strapping it. You know that one where they're exposing their nose and they put it around their mouth? Like, what's the point, right? So, but people are very cautious, right? Because there are spurts of outbreaks, most recently in Xinjiang, in Urumqi. So people are worried, you know, because there are going to be outbreaks, and it's going to continue until we get a vaccine.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's talk about let's pivot to this state of relationships with the U.S. and China.
Sure.
Well, starting with, I guess, the trade war, because, yes, still going on. What's the where are we there? Give us the landscape.
Okay, so tariffs are pretty much imposed on, I think, 2/3 of Chinese products going into the U.S. American products coming into China, pretty much all of them are tacked on with extra tariffs. Those haven't stopped. Some of them have been reduced a little bit, but it still continues. Right now, it's problematic, of course, with all of the logistics and shipping. People are having trouble. And then, of course, there's the currency exchange. A lot of people are finding it much more expensive to get products coming in from the U.S. And so a lot of businesses are trying to pivot and think of different ways to go about it and not raise prices because, of course, as I said, consumers here are struggling and they don't want to pay higher prices. So that's sort of where we are. We have the so-called mini trade deal, a phase one trade deal. China agreed to buy a lot more products from America, and its recent data said that it did reduce the trade deficit a bit. But a lot of it isn't really satisfying the Trump administration. And now the Trump administration is saying that maybe they're not so interested in a second phase. And that's the more important stuff, you know, the nitty gritty details, like what American businesses really wanted. So that's where we're at.
So the deterioration of this relationship has started to get some press here, right? Barr made that speech last week. The president has been saying mean things. And, you know, news consumers here are at least aware. Are people aware there that the relationship is not great?
Not really. And that's by design. The state-run media here has been very low-key from the start for the past 2 years about this so-called trade war. From time to time, it'll post statements from the foreign ministry usually or from Chinese officials responding to American action. But overall, there's very little context. A lot of people aren't really even following it. You know, a lot of times when I'm talking to people about their struggles during the pandemic, very few people are even talking about the U.S.-China trade war.
Well, and I wonder, one of the upticks in American action, some would say finally, in the last few weeks, has been sanctions on some companies related to human rights abuses, related to these allegations that, you know, the Uyghur Muslim population is being rounded up into forced labor camps, that there might be forced sterilization happening, all kinds of alleged human rights abuses. I would assume that is also not in the news.
No. Because China flatly denies that it's doing this. It says it has a very active anti-terrorism program, of course, but that these are education camps. Obviously, this news is has just kind of come out from the U.S. But, you know, when it comes to U.S.-China trade tensions, even from the very start, when I talk to whether they're business people in the export industry or whether they're just ordinary people on the street, most people do not think this is anything to do with human rights, has nothing to do with intellectual property theft or forced tech transfer. They think this is about America's decline. And they're scared and they don't want China rising, period.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So because there's a lot in there. Well, I want to go to technology for a second and the two big stories. One is TikTok, which gets ever increasing amounts of press and how it's basically a data gathering vacuum for the Chinese government. And the other one, of course, is Huawei and its opposition by the Trump administration and the win they had there in the UK, getting Boris Johnson to say, not only can you not have Huawei equipment in your 5G gear, you have to take out the stuff that's there. Seems that's a flashpoint as well.
Yeah, indeed. So Huawei is a prized Chinese company. People are very proud of this company for going abroad and doing so well. It's a telecommunications company. A lot of people have not heard of it in the U.S., I'm pretty sure, until recently. And a lot of people didn't really know much about Huawei until it started making cell phones. And then it tried to go into the U.S. market, and that's sort of where the trouble began. So the U.S. administration has imposed all sorts of restrictions on accessing parts, semiconductors, to not even being able to sell or cooperate with carriers in the U.S. to sell their cell phones. That has got, of course, the Chinese public very worried, I suppose, angry, because it feeds into this perception that this is about stemming China's rise, right? On the flip side with TikTok, it's very interesting because I talked to a Chinese tech journalist and he said that the tech community in China are of two minds. First of all, they're really surprised and a bit baffled because TikTok, national security, where's the link, right? What's the harm about teenagers in the U.S. lip syncing to music and dancing? What does it have to do with national security? On the other hand, they sort of understand if the U.S. wants to ban TikTok, and the Trump administration is saying that there could be a backdoor to TikTok, that the Chinese government can get access to all of this user data. TikTok is not able to operate in China, by the way. There's a different version called Douyin, which is censored. Okay, and if you look at U.S. tech giants like Facebook, Google, Twitter, all of those apps that you use on a daily basis, right? They don't exist in the same form in China and vice versa. Alibaba, Tencent, Huawei, they don't really exist in the U.S. market, right? So what this so-called new Cold War people are referring to, usually what they're talking about are technologies of the future. TikTok's one of them because it's about algorithms, artificial intelligence, right? And they sort of see the merits in why the U.S. wants to ban TikTok because it's maybe only fair because U.S. tech giants can't operate here in China, so why not? Mm-hmm. But of course, the fight is not so much about accessing U.S. or China markets. It's about third-party countries. It's where Google and Facebook and Amazon are coming up against Alibaba and Tencent in Southeast Asia, in India, right? In the Middle East, in Africa. Those are the important markets. And underlying all of that is this allegation that China does not play fair. Not only does it block American companies from entering the Chinese market or impose lots of restrictions on them, but at the same time, they're accusing them of stealing technologies and intellectual property from American companies and then competing with them in global markets.
Right. Hmm. I mean, I think that's what I've always found so fascinating about this, the tech conversation, is that China is arguably the only place in the world where true competition to something like Facebook or Google at, you know, roughly the same scale even exists. And so I wonder, when you hear these allegations that there's theft, that there's, you know, intellectual property theft, certainly some of that, from what we can tell, is empirically true. That is just the case. I remember doing a story years ago about how somewhere in China, they had built a replica, like a complete Intel building. Like, it wasn't really Intel, but all the people who went to work there thought they were working at Intel. I mean, it was just like a straight up clone of an Intel manufacturing. Like, really? I mean, this was like really a story that we did when I was at CNET. And so certainly some of, you know, that intellectual property theft conversation has been going on for decades. When you hear it, though, I wonder how much of it is about protectionism. You know, like, what's the balance of actual cheating versus competition concerns?
I think you have to separate that into different sectors, okay? Certainly, I'm sure in the sensitive industries, espionage and IP theft, that is happening, or there are documented cases, or, you know, that it's happening. But, you know, there are some analysts who talk to me. Let's take the auto sector, for example. This has been a traditionally protected industry where any company like GM or Ford, they have to form joint ventures when they come into China, okay? And these analysts tell me, they said, okay, so let's say that there's forced tech transfer, right? Name one Chinese auto company that has made it very big abroad. I mean, can you name one?
Not right now.
Cannot.
Yeah, I can try to duck quick.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think what their point is, and maybe it's not entirely fair, but what they're trying to point out is that even if there was this policy unofficially to take, you know, tech from American companies and foreign companies, it didn't really give China the edge it needed, okay? But what are the most innovative companies that's going on in China right now? Alibaba and Tencent, right? I mean, I can't tell you the last time I've used cash here in Shanghai, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know about you. I think you guys are still using credit cards, right? But I haven't seen cash in a long time, especially with the pandemic.
Oh, I'm so embarrassed right now.
You backward Americans.
How embarrassing.
That's not my point. I'm not saying that it's a huge innovation, but what I'm saying is that sometimes what Chinese companies are doing is that they're innovating and they're acting very quickly. And there is this thought, like going back to TikTok, for example, you know, and all of these restrictions on Chinese companies, a lot of analysts I've been talking to and observers are saying that what it's really going to do is push the really competitive and really good Chinese companies to be even more competitive. If they really wanted to compete on the global stage, they're going to change, adapt, and figure out a way to survive. So let's look at India, for example, right? Recently, there was a border skirmish, and then the Indian government decided to ban 59 Chinese apps. Right, from the country.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Recently, a lot of these Chinese companies, they relaunched their apps, a light version, and they're surviving. So there is an argument that Chinese companies, because they work in this very opaque system and, you know, policies change on a dime and it's like, you know, uncharted territory, unwritten rules, reading between the lines, they're much more adept and flexible and nimble sometimes to change and shift their business model to adapt. And so this is really the big question for American companies is, can they? Because what this U.S.-China trade tension or new Cold War, whatever you want to call it, is doing is make it a very rocky terrain for businesses to navigate, because it used to be quite easy for them to just say, you know what, I don't dabble in Tiananmen, Taiwan, or Tibet, or any sensitive political topics, I should be fine. But now it's really difficult because business is sensitive. It's difficult for us to even get normal interviews from analysts or companies because they hear we're an American outlet and they say, no, I don't want to talk to you. So that's what is at stake, is that it's very difficult for companies to navigate. And you know what? Political risk companies are probably making a killing if if they're advertising.
Yeah, sure. Well, so look, yeah, so to that, right, and the political situation, and setting aside the Chinese government being totalitarian and the United States right now politically being split asunder intentionally, right, by its leadership, what does the business environment there feels like? Because you are painting a picture of a really adept, innovative, agile, and ambitious corporate mindset. While here, yes, there's some of that, and look, maybe this is because I've been stuck in a room attached to my garage for 114 days or whatever it is, but it feels like we're stuck and not adjusting to the new reality.
I think, again, to not give you a straight answer, I think it depends from sector to sector. So if you're not TikTok or the parent company ByteDance, if you're not Alibaba, you're not Tencent, you're not Google, Facebook, you know, I think a lot of people still feel there are great opportunities in China, because guess what? China is the first one hit with the pandemic, the first one out. For all intents and purposes, businesses is restarting. A lot of businesses are saying if they're going to generate any revenue this year, it's going to be from the China market. And a lot of people want in. So there are lots of businesses who are optimistic if they're outside of, you know, the tech sphere, let's say, or the sensitive industries, who feel there are great opportunities here. But those are the ones who really, really want to be here. Okay. There are equally those who feel it's, you know, really rocky terrain. And the problem is that while China says it's not exporting its model abroad, more and more companies have to watch not only what it does in mainland China, but it also its global operations, what it's saying. Look at NBA, for example, right? It got itself in trouble. And guess what? I think the Houston Rockets are, I mean, even if they had games, they're still not being broadcast here. You know, that page is sort of blank on the broadcasters. So they're not really back. South Korean businesses. So you look at Korean pop or Korean dramas, Korean TV and movies. No new ones have been released for the past 2 years or maybe a bit more after South Korea agreed to host an anti-ballistic missile system from the U.S. called THAAD. And so China got upset. And so that was sort of its punishment. And they still haven't really resumed any of that business.
Yeah. Well, so this is what I wonder, because, and this plays into, you know, the new Hong Kong security law. There is, it seems, a tightening overall around media, obviously, speech, Hong Kong. Is there a point at which, you know, China had great economic success by having a more open posture? And I wonder, as you see what seems to be the country really closing ranks, becoming a little bit more authoritarian, and the NBA doesn't come there, and there aren't any Korean dramas, like, is there a point at which that could actually threaten China's economic growth?
I think that Chinese officials are very pragmatic, let's just say, because at this point, while the Trump administration is, you know, very loud about its anti-China stance sometimes, most people would agree that China's response has been quite measured. So let's go back to the state media not really covering it too well. They're not trying to generate anti-Americanism or feelings, right? In terms of Hong Kong is really the only part of China that is a true global financial hub. I'm in Shanghai, which is supposed to be a financial hub, but there are currency restrictions. There's no free internet or a free court system. Hong Kong has that for now, okay? And, of course, the danger is with this new national security law, which is set out to prevent secession, subversion, terrorism, and foreign interference, quote-unquote, the U.S., then, you know, what could happen? And that's the fear. And it really would hinder global companies like American companies. There's a large American contingent in Hong Kong, by the way. They set up their Asia headquarters there. How are they going to recruit people if people are worried? They don't know, you know, what's going to happen to them if, say, maybe they write the wrong thing on Facebook, which, by the way, is available in Hong Kong, not in mainland China. Mm-hmm. It becomes a very kind of rocky terrain. That's the only way I could describe it. I don't know. There might be a better metaphor for it. But I think it's the political is now the economic, like it's all combined now and the gap is closing. It's very difficult for companies. I mean, look at HSBC. It's not enough to just keep quiet. Now they had to come out and support the national security law, right? So it's difficult, I think, for businesses. So you'd have to really, really want to be here. And there are lots of businesses who really, really want to operate in mainland China.
So what's your guess, Jennifer? Last thing on the way out here. What's your guess? Does this get worse before it gets better, or is this the low with all this talk of a new Cold War?
Gosh, you know what? I would never venture to predict anything because anybody who says they know will be wrong. But I will say, every person who has been here, and I'm sure it was true when you were here, Kai, everyone always says that this is the new low. This has never been seen before. Yeah. I think we're just going to, you know, go along as it goes. I don't really know. I mean, right now, even as you said, news information has become sensitive, right? They kicked out, one day the Trump administration says they're going to impose restrictions on Chinese media outlets in the U.S. Next day, U.S. journalists from the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, they have less than 10 days to get out. That's unheard of, right? So it's hard to say. I think there's argument for both. I don't really see maybe it going better. I don't know if this is the worst, though. I think that's the really shoddy answer I have. I'm sorry.
No, look, it's a real answer, right? And nobody knows.
It's a real
answer. Smart not to try to predict. Jennifer Pack is our correspondent in Shanghai, up at what is now 1:37 in the morning her time. Jennifer, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Jennifer. Back to bed.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, awesome to have her on. Second of all, yeesh, right? You know,
it's so fascinating. So fascinating, the complete difference in perspective and knowledge and awareness. And like, you could be sitting in America thinking, oh, we are definitely going to war with China. This is not good. You know, this is like terrible.
Yeah.
And maybe ask any person on the street in Shanghai who isn't Jennifer Pack, and they'd be like, oh, no, it seems fine.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're going to crush. It's just a matter of time. I don't know. I think I'm just fascinated by the complete difference in information.
Yeah. And attitude and mindset, the whole deal.
Yeah, exactly. Back. Also, that Uyghur Muslim thing is cannot get enough coverage. It really is terrible. Yeah.
Okay.
On
that note, we're taking a break. Send us your comments, please, on today's show. Thoughts about China, good, bad, otherwise. Also, your questions for tomorrow. What do you want to know Wednesday? MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Coming back, we are.
And we're back. I was during the break-ish trying to find that story that I mentioned because I didn't want. I'm not good at details
thing?
All the time. No. The fake, the entire fake factory, Intel factory, and I couldn't find it because my memory is fuzzy because this was like a while ago. I'm thinking like 2005, 2006. But I did find that will be in our show notes, a story from 2011 about how there was a fake Apple store in Shanghai that was so real that not only did it fool potential customers, it fooled the employees also.
Yes.
I'm still sure that the other one that I mentioned is real in some form. I just can't find it right now because apparently the internet doesn't go back very far anymore.
China is amazing.
They don't mess around.
Nope.
with the knockoffs. All right. News fix. Mine looks terrifying, I know. So you can start.
It does. You know why? Because there's one, two, three, four. There's four items here. But you're going to say, oh, no, they're all the same thing. So that's fine.
They're
we'll do that
the
when we get
thing.
There.
Mine's
a quickie. And this is clearly the international edition of the Tuesday Make Me Smart because we had China. And now I want to go to the European Union for a minute because today they made a huge deal. All 27 countries in the European Union, used to be 28, hello Brexit, all 27 countries have agreed on a recovery spending plan. And a couple of things about it. Number one, it had to be unanimous, which is amazing that they got it done. Apparently, it was like 5 days of really brutal negotiations. But also, just sort of geopolitically, I think it's and I'm sure this is on that drinking card game that came up yesterday. It's interesting because even as there are forces that are pulling the European Union apart, right? Hello, Brexit again. Yeah. They were able to come to a deal which will draw Europe closer together for a long period of time. And that is worth a note because, let me just put my marketplace hat on here for a second, it collectively is the biggest economy in the world, right? 450 million people. I couldn't tell you how many trillions of dollars worth of GDP. It's the biggest consumer market as a unit. And it matters. It matters in a very substantive way for us and for the global economy. And that's why I think everybody should know that the Europeans got their debt relief and corona recovery plan together this past weekend.
Well, and what is the – it's super fascinating on a number of levels because, yes, the European Union was sort of tearing itself apart, including resistance from, you know, the more well-off companies, countries. Yeah. I literally am to the point, by the way, in late stage – global capitalism, where I keep mixing up the word country and company, which I feel like is Freudian in a weird way that I need to interrogate. Anyway, the wealthier countries like Germany and I think France, like they had opposed a big deal like this, right? Because it was like buying debt from the poorer countries. Is that right? I feel like there's like a bond thing in here that is also a big deal because it sort of means they're all invested in each other in a way that they hadn't been before. They were building very standalone economies.
That is absolutely correct. They're borrowing collectively, right? That debt piece is that they are borrowing collectively, which is huge. It's huge.
It's huge. And it was the frugal four, Austria, Denmark, the Netherlands, and Sweden. Yes. And they were like, no way are we taking on this debt. Oh, my God, it's like Hamilton all over again. If we assume state debt, the union gets a – you'd rather give it a sedative. We listen to that
something, something diuretic, right? Economic diuretic.
You'd rather – you'd rather give it a sedative, something diuretic. Anyway, it's that. That's what they did. Federalism in the EU. Fascinating.
Boom. And you worked in the Hamilton reference.
Version two of the drinking card is really going to have a lot of good stuff on it.
Yes.
So this, my news fix is a little bit of a departure because it's not like a big giant thing in the news. It is more a classic Make Me Smart obsession, which is that I was recently alerted to by a friend of mine who's a lawyer who's been, is on like a civil rights advocacy group that's trying to deal with the fact that in the middle of the pandemic, multiple states are insisting on in-person bar exams. And there has obviously been, it has been as many as 23 states that were insisting on it. I think maybe like several have canceled just in the past week or so. But there definitely are still more. Wisconsin is one of them. North Carolina is one of them. And they're planning to hold these in-person bar exams within the next 7 days. So at a time when, you know, obviously the pandemic is really raging. Now, that is problematic, obviously, because it means that sort of like if you would like to take the bar exam, you have to either put yourself at risk or be already healthy. Mm-hmm. And so there are like Twitter threads from people who are like, I'm immunocompromised or I want to take this. There's a thread from a single mom who's a two-time cancer survivor who wants to become an attorney to take care of her son who is immunocompromised and is like, you're going to make me come in person in North Carolina and take this exam. And then all of that outrage led me down the rabbit hole of this idea of diploma privilege, which like every other or most other profession says, if you get a diploma in a thing, you can practice that thing, which is how things used to be until around 1912 when apparently the American Bar Association, quote, accidentally granted three black lawyers membership, most likely, according to this Twitter thread I found, because they didn't realize they were black. Then they convened a meeting and decided that the way to keep the profession, quote, pure, would be to set up an exam. And so this idea of diploma privilege is gaining a lot of steam, as people say, and I'm quoting from this Danielle Craig in her Twitter thread, who's a Berkeley Law 2020 grad, Berkeley Law student. And she says, in my view and the view of many others, the bar exam serves as an antiquated hazing ritual, which I think we can argue is never more true than when they're going to cram hundreds of people into a room to take the test all at the same time in person because precious.
Yeah.
And I think it is super fascinating. And it really, and although it seems like a moment in time, obviously, if you look at the consequences of this particular type of gatekeeping, well, then that's who makes our laws. That's who decides, you know, issues of massive social import. That's who ends up on the Supreme Court. Like, this is a big deal and has been essentially an elitist and, in these days, dangerous practice for 100 years. Boom. Made you smart.
There you go. Made you smart. Now you know something about the bargain.
So interesting. Boom. So interesting.
Yep.
That's my rabbit hole for today.
Totally. All those links, by the way, on the show page. Tony's going to put them there.
Yes. Yep. Yes. He is. They're like seven. They'll keep coming. All right. Let's do the mailbag.
It's all good.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
That's what I just did. All right. Two weeks back. we talked about childcare with Valerie Strauss, how it is on track to become a real crisis. Like, I don't know, now has been, will get much worse.
Yeah, on track.
When parents are forced to. Yeah, I mean, it is a real crisis. And parents are forced. There was a great, sorry, Tony, I'm going to get to this link. But there was a great piece by Jason Gay in The Wall Street Journal that was basically all of us with children. And it was literally like the only thing any of us are talking about is school. You could be like, did you see the video of the eagle grabbing the shark out of the water? What is it going to work if they go 1 or 2 days? Like, is it possible that they can actually do 3 hours of it? It's just it is incredible.
Right.
Incredible. So Josh Miner from La Crosse, Wisconsin, wrote in to comment on this topic. And here's what he said. We have two kids, 14 and 10. And 14 years ago, my wife and I made the very calculated decision to move from Oakland, California to a small town where my wife could earn enough for us to have a comfortable life and for me to be a stay-at-home dad. I've had jobs on and off over the years, but my real job was childcare provider and is now homemaker. It looks like I'll be remote learning coach mentor starting in September. These positions have real value, as my wife continually reminds me when I feel like a slouch, and we should treat them as such at a policy level. Uh-huh. So maybe before plowing a whole bunch of money into childcare programs, which will obviously be needed too, we should first institute a guaranteed basic income so a parent could choose to stay home and provide childcare to their kids if they wanted to avoid what was a giant fiasco before this pandemic and has now become a real economy level crisis.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. This was the moment to try that, right? Yeah. We're spending trillions and trillions of dollars. And there was a moment here where we kind of tried guaranteed basic income. And we would have seen what would have happened. And look, they've done it in Europe. We've talked about it on this podcast before, right? It took the form of something else, right? It was the government basically paying salaries. But this was the moment. And, you know, that first of all, that moment's gone. And second of all, American politics. And third of all, who knows if we can even get another aid package out the door to figure out the expanded unemployment benefits. But, yeah, was a moment.
The only quibble that I'm going to have there is this moment is nowhere near over, I would say. And and so it's probably gone with respect to our current Congress. But
oh, yeah, for sure.
This crisis isn't going anywhere. The question of childcare isn't going anywhere. Like, in theory, there is still there is still more than a moment to say right this second, like, we're going to pay you for childcare. We're going to pay you to do this work. And there's been a whole conversation about that for years. And now there's not going to be a better time to have it because we're in for at least another year of this. Phase 4,
really?
People.
A year? A year?
Yeah, dude. I feel like I'm always like the doomsayer. Remember, like, a month ago or something when I said, if I'm going to be in this house for another 4 months, and you were like, what? It's going to be like 3 more weeks. I'm just your big buzzkill.
Okay.
What signs do you see that we are not going to be in this for another year?
Yeah, nothing. Nothing. All right. So we've done a couple of pandemic silver linings here on this podcast the last couple of weeks. Joe and his new startup from a number of weeks. We're just moving on. Katie and her sheep on Vermont, if you remember that one. And now Michi Rigier is going to do a Zoom fiddle camp, and she wanted to share her experience with us. Here is what she sent us.
Hi, Molly and Kai. I wanted to share a silver lining with you that was not even imaginable before this pandemic. I'm going to fiddle camp. As a 40-something accountant who closed on a house in March, I thought I would have to wait 20 years for this kind of flexibility. But for 6 days, it's 3 hours of classes with breaks in between and then a jam in the evening. And I don't have to fly to Florida or stay in a hotel. I feel like a child, and it's wonderful. Here's the tune we learned yesterday in the fun meter of 5.
Wow. This is definitely not Hot Cross Bun. Wow. Wow.
That was amazing.
Get out of town. That was so cool. That was
I love this.
Let me, as long as we're on the topic of fiddle, let me give a plug here to a former marketplacer. He's on the Friday show every now and then. David Gura, grew up in North Carolina, plays the fiddle, and I don't even know what kind of music it is. But he, every Tuesday night, he lives in a brownstone in New York, in Manhattan, no, in Brooklyn, sorry, with his wife and 3 young children. He is, by the way, just parenthetically going out of his mind with those 3 little kids. She probably more than he, because that's the way it happens now. But every Tuesday night, he goes up on the roof and he takes out his fiddle and he records something for like 2 minutes and puts it on his Twitter feed. And it's, I think he's at David Gura, G-U-R-A. Check it out. It's cool. But this was awesome. This was super cool. And she was good, too.
That was
I was totally expecting hot cross buns, right? Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I was... maybe fiddle camp isn't her first rodeo with respect to actually playing that instrument.
That's what I was expecting.
Clearly.
That's what I was expecting. Also,
if it were me.
Also,
that was absolutely
wonderful. I have not learned how to play the piano in this quarantine, as I promised myself I would. Just, you know, keeping myself accountable.
I have grown a bunch of tomatoes.
That was great. I dug that.
So many tomatoes.
Yes.
And I have a new design for mask making that I'm very excited about. It's related to the buff. Yeah, you know the tube, the gaiter, the neck gaiter?
Yeah.
I've decided that the neck gaiter, if you watch Survivor, you know it's the most useful piece of gear you can ever own. I have them because it could be like a neck thing and a headband and a pillowcase and a dress. Yeah. But I love to wear mine and use it as a mask because it's super like easy and accessible. And then I was like, this thing needs ear loops and a filter pocket. And then luckily YouTube obliged me in a video just 3 days ago. This lady had the same idea as me. So I figured out how to put ear loops on one. And then I ordered a bunch of fabric and I'm like, I can just sew in a stretchy little filter pocket. Yoink. Boom. Wow. Project. I got to do something, man.
Project.
Okay. We are going to end as we often do on the Make Me Smart question. This week, Jed Kim, maybe a name familiar to some or all of you, the host also of the brand new podcast from Marketplace called Million Bazillion. I love everything about this and it's so fun and I'm going to listen to it even though I'm not a child. It's answering all of the weird questions that kids have about money. And in this case, he is answering our question. And here he goes.
One thing I thought I knew, and I'm going to cut myself some slack here because almost everybody makes this mistake, is assuming that money started as a way to improve bartering. Like, trading stuff for other stuff is inefficient, so money comes in to be a stand-in, and everyone's happy, and humanity develops into a new golden age of getting stuff done. Turns out, money probably started as a way to strengthen relationships. Like, you'd give someone a token that would show everyone you were buddies who were going to take care of each other. The irony is that these days, money is so far from that. In fact, it's almost like the act of handing money over absolves us of having to relate to each other. And maybe that's a shame. Then again, I really do enjoy being able to buy unhealthy bacon donuts from someone I'm never going to have to see again.
Cash only. They can't trace it. I'm just saying.
I think you in America, you're still using cash there, right?
I know, right? How funny was that? How funny was that?
Oh, so great. I love that. By the way, guys, you have to listen to Million Bazillion. The name is so great. The first episode is out today. It's aimed at kids like 8 to 12-ish, but I think that grown-ups are going... If I am any indication, although I'm somewhat childish, grown-ups are going to like it too.
Subscribe, because that's what really makes the ratings go up, and that's, you know, oh so important in this time when everybody has a podcast, and we got some good ones. So check it out, Million Bazillion. This podcast, however, is done for the day. Check our smart speaker explainers. If you would, just ask that Echo device to make me smart. We're going to be back tomorrow with What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Questions to the usual address, makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
You know, if we show up. We show up.
No promises.
We're going to show up.
That's the plan. That's the plan.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by me, Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. He does an amazing job on the web presence, not just for us, but for a lot of the Marketplace podcasts. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and smart speaker skills with great style and flair. She also helps out on tons of other projects like Econ 101 and the new Million Bazillion podcast, which you should subscribe to. Ben Hefko is our ace video producer and the reason why the live streams and the YouTube videos happen. Ethan Parrots is our tireless intern who helps me sort through the mailbag and pull out all the good stuff you guys send in. Today's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez and mixed by Drew Jostad. Safe to say the show literally wouldn't happen without them. Our theme music, and also the Happy and Dark Place stings and lots of other music, were composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Satara Nieves is the executive director of On Demand and also has the best sense of humor of any boss I've ever worked for. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, who I've actually never had a personal conversation with. Hey, Deb. And of course, thanks to our incredible hosts, Molly Banana Pants Wood and Kai One Fun Rizdahl.
Aww.
So you know what's great about that? You know what's great about that? Sam spent so much time buttering everybody up that he ran out of time.
He ran out of music.
Oh, what's this? A live microphone? Here.
Amazing.
My Lord.
Who knew? Who knew that all this time he was like, just give me that mic?
Yep.
See you tomorrow, folks.